You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Did you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
A 2011 study from the Entertainment Software Association, a leading industry trade group, showed that 72% of American households are playing computer or video games and spending over $25 billion annually to do so. Gamers usually aren't just spending this money on the initial purchase of the game. More and more, games are building purchases into the gameplay, allowing gamers to pay to unlock certain powers, levels, and privileges in games. This raises some serious questions about ownership. As gamers buy property and privileges within a virtual world, they are entering into a whole set of agreements about what they're allowed to do with that property, and raising all sorts of thorny questions about who owns what, under what jurisdiction, and whether the property even really exists at all. Greg Listoka is a professor of law at Rutgers University and author of the book Virtual Justice. I spoke to him about what virtual property is and who it belongs to.
Tell me what Virtual Justice is all about.
It's a book about virtual worlds and law. And virtual worlds are a specific phenomenon that I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the internet generally, but about places like World of Warcraft or Second Life or Club Penguin. And basically, these are kind of online, persistent, simulated spaces where users interact through avatars. So it's about that particular technology and its history and the way that laws are being applied to it.
When people think about those kinds of worlds like Second Life and World of Warcraft, you know, your average person is probably thinking about some nerd in their parents' basement or, you know, for Club Penguin, something that they're, you know, just fun for their kids to play with. These are toys.
The popular perception of the demographics of virtual worlds is pretty much off in that I think the majority of households have game consoles now, and the size of virtual worlds today in terms of the populations in them, World of Warcraft has 12 million people, Club Penguin has 12 million kids, Second Life has 50 million registered accounts, and my definition would include spaces like Farmville, which is 60 million users. So I think, you know, from those examples, you can see that there is a high level of game, you know, playing going on here. There's a kind of game context. But at the same time, I don't think just because this is a context where people are playing and it's kind of leisure activity, that that removes the whole area, the whole media from legal questions. In fact, I think it raises more interesting legal questions because people seem to view these as fun and somehow outside of the law.
You start off the book with an analogy of three different kinds of castles as an entry point into talking about how virtual worlds are governed. You know, can you explain that analogy and how it represents online worlds?
Yeah, sure. Well, I use the analogy of the castle. The castle historically was a new kind of military technology that was used, you know, by its controllers and by its community as a way of separating themselves from external power. You know, so the rulers of the castle actually set up their own courts and, you know, pronounce the laws and set the regulations for their kind of castle communities. And I thought that was really interesting and a good analogy for what's happening in virtual worlds, in that when you create a kind of server platform for users and you create a space for them to interact in, and you use software to set up the rules of the platform, to a certain extent, you're creating your own separate sphere of governance, and you have a great deal of control just via your control over the technology, over the way that people interact and the way that, you know, they exchange value and the way they communicate through your platform. So I talk about Disney's kind of creation of a separate zone and its Magic Kingdom, where people can step out and, you know, adventure in certain ways. But at the same time, that zone is heavily controlled by Disney, and it's sort of an amusement park setting where everyone sort of thinks that this is not real, but at the same time, it's enjoyable and something that's worth spending money on. And then the final kind of castle I'll talk about in the introduction is this eBay castle on Dagger Island that sold well, it's not an eBay castle, but it's a castle in Ultima Online. But it's a piece of virtual property in the game. And a player actually was selling that when I first encountered it several years ago for about $1,000 on eBay. And the question I asked was, you know, this person is in control of the castle within the virtual world of Ultima Online, and obviously they have the right to exclude others, you know, in the simulation from entering into that castle. But do they actually legally own the property that they're able to use and to sell? And generally speaking, most of the terms of service and end user license agreements say that even though you might have the fantasy of being the owner of virtual property, that actually the platform owner is the sole owner of anything within the game, and there is no user right to virtual property. Now, some virtual worlds actually change that, and they say that you can own virtual land. So, for instance, Second Life was kind of built on that kind of approach to user ownership and economic interest in virtual property. But at the same time, even in Second Life, the terms of service and end user license agreement often favor the interests of the platform owner over the interests of the user. So again, I'm making an analogy to the medieval castle and saying that the people that actually own the equipment of the virtual worlds have the power to basically set their own rules for property, for social interaction. They have the ability to kind of create virtual societies and be the overlords of those societies in a way that is unusual and new and worth talking about.
In some ways, that's the perfect analogy because, you know, in medieval times, you might may have owned property, but, you know, the whoever owned, you know, the domain, the feudal lord that ruled over the entire countryside could do whatever they wanted with the area if they had a whim to come and knock down your, you know, your shack or your castle, they could do so. It seems like what you're saying is, you know, these virtual platform owners do have a domain over the virtual property owners.
Right. And it's interesting, in the history of property law, the feudal kind of system of property was based upon a duty of loyalty and allegiance and service to the lord, you know, on the part of the vassal. To a certain extent, the terms of service or end user license agreement of virtual worlds kind of replicates that. As long as you're on good terms with the platform owner, you can, you know, call yourself, you know, the lord of your little piece of the virtual world. But when you get on the virtual world owner's bad side, they have the power to basically revoke, you know, all of your virtual property interests and cancel your connection to the virtual world. So, yeah, I do think there are kind of strong echoes of feudalism in what's happening in virtual worlds today.
You'd mentioned the Linden case. I wonder if you can explain that.
Yeah, so it's Bragg versus Linden Research, which is about Linden Lab, the owner of Second Life. And Mark Bragg is a lawyer in Pennsylvania who bought thousands of dollars of virtual land in Second Life and also created some original content, some artifacts, fireworks, actually, that he had stored in some of these properties. Apparently, he bid on an auction where the auction was unlisted for a new piece of land. Second Life, the Linden Lab, the owners of Second Life, canceled his account, which meant that he lost not only the land that he had bid on and purchased, but he also lost the additional land that he had already owned. So basically, his account was terminated, all of his assets were resold, and they said, you know, you're not permitted to be part of Second Life any longer. So as a reaction to that, he sued and he said, please, you know, he told the court that I either need to be compensated for the conversion of my land or I need to, you know, have my property restored to me. The initial ruling in the case actually sided with Bragg over Linden Lab. The only real issue decided in that opinion was the enforceability of the arbitration provision in the contract. But the court said that the provision in that contract was unconscionable and could not be enforced against Bragg because it was too one-sided. There were too many burdens placed on Bragg, and the arbitration clause was too favorable to Linden Lab. That was a major decision. I think it's a major decision, you know, for internet law generally, not just for virtual worlds law. In that, you know, here's an online contract the court says is too one-sided to be enforced. And when the arbitration clause is gone, then Second Life is faced with the possibility that the court might actually recognize user interest in virtual property. And probably for that reason, the sides settled the case shortly afterwards.
I really wonder what the other side of the argument is there, because if you don't view this as virtual property, as a kind of a new domain where individuals still have rights within that domain that are inherent regardless of the terms of service, I wonder what, you know, Linden Labs or whoever is running the platform would say. Is this more of we're providing the forum or the user experience? It's more of a consumer vendor relationship.
Yeah, I mean, so it's not just Second Life that's concerned about this. I think increasingly, video games are becoming more networked. We're having more platforms where you know, the solo experience is being replaced with a multi-user experience. And increasingly, we're seeing companies interested in using multiplayer spaces as ways to generate revenues through micropayments, sales of virtual property. So that's a major, you know, business now. We're talking at least $2 billion, probably $4, maybe $6 billion being traded for virtual property today. Yeah, and companies are well aware of this. So your Microsoft, your EA, they're all aware that things are moving in this direction. And what they would really like to have is a system where when players buy, you know, virtual currencies or buy virtual property, that that is construed legally as providing, you know, a service, and there are no further legal complications that have to do with, you know, with banking or with property law. Because, you know, the minute that we actually recognize some kind of legal property interest on the part of the player, there are all sorts of complications that arise. You know, do players need, you know, this is on the part of players, do players need to file tax returns based upon their holdings in virtual property? So the companies are very interested in doing all that they can to make sure that they do not give players a kind of legal interest in virtual currency or virtual property. At the same time, the thing that's really enjoyable about virtual currency and virtual property is all of the ways in which it simulates your real property ownership. So at the same time, they would want, you know, in terms of marketing, I think they would want players to think, you know, yeah, I actually do have something like a real currency. I do have something like a real property interest. And they want to keep their customers happy. So they don't want to go, you know, abusing, being tyrannical with relation to the consumers. So it'll be very interesting. I think we're seeing Facebook has a virtual currency. It's increasingly being used as a gaming platform. All of the, you know, console makers are pushing towards more networked experiences and more of these micropayment models. So it's going to be very interesting times, I think, for the next few years as courts try to figure out and companies do their best to prevent courts from determining, you know, that players actually do have significant legal interest in virtual property.
You are listening to Radio Berkman. I'm Daniel Dennis Jones. This week, we're featuring an interview with Greg Listoka, a professor of law at Rutgers University and the author of the book Virtual Justice. We talked about the gray areas in property ownership in virtual worlds. Can you really say a castle you buy in an online game belongs to you, or do the game administrators have eminent domain? But there's also a phenomenon of more traditional criminal behavior linked to virtual worlds.
And this is not real crime so much as it is simulated crime. So any video game, not any video game, but many video games involve destruction, you know. So Grand Theft Auto, I guess, would be the leading example of a video game that's all about, you know, criminal violence and destruction. So when that becomes networked, then the victims on the other side are other players, right? But when you play a video game, you understand that your avatar might be murdered, for instance. When you turn this into a video game with a virtual currency with many, many players, you have something like EVE Online, which is a kind of libertarian fantasy virtual world that takes place in an alternate galaxy. And the fascinating thing about EVE Online is that players are encouraged to essentially deceive and defraud other players and to attack, you know, other players and steal their assets. And that's what the game is all about. But all the people that play the game, I think, understand that that's the way it's played. When you overlay a virtual economy on top of that, then you have people who are sometimes investing real money in the virtual world and consenting to an arena where they can be defrauded by other players and their virtual assets can be stolen. You could say that a situation like an investment scam in EVE Online is a virtual crime because, you know, if you were to overlay the actual criminal laws on top of this behavior, there's no reason, I think, that it would be exempt, no clear reason would be exempt from criminal prosecution. At the same time, I don't think there will be many criminal prosecutions because this is a kind of situation that players often consent to when they enter into these spaces. So I think it's very interesting, but I don't think it's something that is going to end up in courts anytime soon. I might be wrong about that. But the other kind of aspect of this is, what about behaviors where people are making real money from virtual property in ways that are outside the scope of the game rules and outside the scope of what the players consent to? So, for instance, I talk about in my chapter on hackers, I talk about the Tayturf worm, which is a virus that essentially steals all of your account login information and then enables the people that created the virus to go and harvest all the virtual property from your accounts and to resell that to other players. This is probably very profitable for the virus creators, but the object of the crime is you know, that what they're looking for is virtual property. And given the uncertainty about ownership of virtual property and the value of virtual property, this might be a crime that is, you know, without any form of real damage. I talk about in the beginning of the book about the case of Kui Cheng Wei, where this is a Chinese gamer who acquires a particularly powerful sword in the virtual world of Legend of Mir. And this sword is actually worth, as a piece of virtual property, around $800 or so. And he lets his friend borrow the sword. His friend asks if he can borrow the sword. His friend actually turns around and sells the sword to another player for real money. He goes to the police, the Chinese police, and complains about the theft. He says, my friend stole my virtual sword. And the police turn him away and say, that isn't real property. You can't do anything about that because you had no ownership interest in that. So he thinks about that for a while. He, you know, his friend has basically $800 of what, you know, should have been his money. It's a real value gain for his friend, but the state won't enforce his loss. So he actually goes to his friend's house, confronts him, and ends up killing his friend. Really, the case is a criminal case where he receives a death penalty. But, you know, the question is, if the state refuses to deal with situations where valuable property is being stolen because it has a sort of deference to these places as game spaces, or even a kind of dismissiveness about these spaces as game spaces, it creates the possibility of spillover where people take the law into their own hands. And property law is supposed to prevent that sort of thing. That's the goal of it, that the state can actually mediate when we have disputes like this. And in the case of virtual worlds, it might not be doing that effectively.
In some ways, you almost can't blame the state for wanting to stay out of it a little bit, because the precedent that could be set by doing so could result in some sort of legal chaos, because there's got to be infinite numbers of different kind of virtual worlds, and each of them with their own jurisdictional rules. And navigating through each of these groups' terms of service and what's a crime where, you know, it would take a whole new system of governance to deal with it.
Right. No, that's absolutely correct. And I think we worry about some judges, you know, who confront, you know, new phenomena on the internet generally. But with regard to these virtual worlds, determining what the reasonable expectations of users are can be extremely difficult, because usually the way that the terms of service are written, you can't really even depend upon them for, you know, gauging where users' expectations are. Because, you know, if 1% of people actually read terms of service as an end user license agreement, and even the ones that read them, you know, if they're not lawyers, they probably don't understand exactly what they're saying. The way that we get to kind of norms of behavior in virtual worlds is through, you know, kind of trial and error within the community. And I think there are cases in which norms are established, but it's awfully difficult, I think, for the fact finder to figure out what those norms are. So as you said, I think there's a incredible administrative hurdles to a court actually reaching a good policy decision with regard to a dispute arising in a virtual world. And that's one reason, I think, to not be too dismayed, I think, about virtual justice kind of emerging from these platforms. So I talk about the ways in which some of the platforms, you know, have created community rules, community standards, in which the owners of the platform sometimes enforce those standards. And it's not always perfect the way in which they do this kind of, you know, policing. But there are, you know, some rules and standards that they will enforce just to, you know, make their customers happy. There's another problem with enforcement. It's not just about the legal uncertainty, but it's about internet issues generally, and that's jurisdiction. If you have a dispute with someone else in a virtual world, who is that person? You know, you know what their avatar is, but you don't know, you know, who they are, where they are. They could be in a different country. To get jurisdiction over a citizen of a foreign country, you've got to go through some incredible legal hurdles. And local law enforcement officers, you know, when they're, you know, when somebody comes and complains about a theft in a virtual world, might be wisely deciding that the administrative resources that it would take to track down this person and do something about it are just better spent on more local matters. It's understandable that when users are harmed in virtual worlds, they turn first to the platform owner, you know, for some sort of justice. And in a way, that's the theme of the book, that the platform owner kind of steps into the role of a kind of governmental authority over the virtual world. And in some cases, they don't want that role. They'd much rather avoid that role. But in a way, it's their customer service responsibility to administer justice on their platforms.
Well, it has to do with the spirit of the web in a way, because a lot of these virtual worlds started out as just very entrepreneurial, independent projects, just that were inspired by the possibilities of the web and not too concerned with the potential legal hurdles and the behavior problems and all the hypotheticals that could happen down the road.
That's true. And it's what's interesting, you know, to me is that, and kind of unfortunate in a way, is that some of the most innovative virtual worlds, I think Second Life is incredibly innovative. It started out, actually, the history of Second Life started out as an effort to develop a kind of standard multiplayer video game. But they found that when users actually started making use of the creative tools that they had made available, they made some pretty incredible stuff. So it turned into a virtual world based upon user-generated content. By giving the users greater power over the environment, greater creative freedom, and taking the virtual economy very seriously and kind of enabling people to invest in the economy, I think Second Life has kind of painted a big target on itself for litigation, whereas virtual worlds that are more locked down, that don't allow a lot of user-generated content, that kind of keep investments lower, tend to sail more safely through, you know, uncertain legal waters and can be more profitable. So, you know, I think it's kind of unfortunate because I think innovation is something we want to promote. We want to promote these sorts of experiments. But just like any kind of web venture, I think the more ambitious and kind of, you know, radical projects, even though they can be more socially constructive, tend to run afoul of the law more often.
You're listening to Radio Berkman. I'm Daniel Dennis Jones. This week, we're featuring an interview with Greg Listoka, a professor of law at Rutgers University and author of the book Virtual Justice. With potentially millions of different virtual worlds operating simultaneously on the web as we speak, I asked Greg if any of them had figured out how to deal with criminal behavior within their own realms.
Are there any examples of virtual worlds that you've come across? And by virtual worlds, I mean, you know, and in the broadest sense, not just these worlds that we're talking about, like Second Life, but any kind of virtual community online, Wikipedia could be included. Are there any examples of these kinds of virtual communities that you've come across that have actually managed to successfully navigate the potential legal hurdles?
I guess no. That's a pretty easy answer. Just to go back to the issue of virtual property, you can put into the terms of service and end user license agreements all that you can to make sure that users have kind of zero rights in virtual property. And that's a way to prevent litigation over virtual property and keep the power consolidated in the hands of the platform owner. And I think many virtual worlds try to do that. But the question is, you know, are those agreements enforceable? When push comes to shove and you have a difficult case, will the court uphold those contracts? And I think that's unclear at this point. I think there are companies with excellent lawyers who represent, you know, these platform owners, but I don't know that they have succeeded clearly in protecting themselves from legal uncertainty. There are some, you know, virtual worlds that have attempted to use community input to kind of craft where they're going, but you always have dissenters and you always have people who interpret, you know, their investments in different ways. So no, I don't think there's any virtual world out there that I would say, well, you know, this has got all the issues figured out and there's no possibility of problems down the road. You know, and you know, it's different jurisdictions are handling these issues in different ways. The government of South Korea, I think, the Republic of Korea, has been more forward-looking, I think, than many with regard to its legislation over virtual worlds. So there are specific laws in South Korea that divide virtual worlds into different sorts of platforms. There's a kind of police beat in South Korea that handles virtual crimes. There have been many prosecutions for fraud in relation to virtual property. So, but Seoul is a very kind of technologically advanced place, and they have a history of gaming and kind of a cultural investment in these online games. So in a way, it's not surprising that I think they're in many ways a few steps ahead of us on these issues. The big question is, to what extent can these platforms establish themselves as sort of separate jurisdictions? And but I should be clear about what I mean by that idea of a separate jurisdiction. I don't think virtual worlds will be recognized by nations as, you know, kind of sovereign governments over their users, because the users are all located in real space. And in a way, this goes back to John Perry Barlow and his Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, where he suggested that you could actually have a kind of independent political consciousness on the internet. And I think in the ensuing years after he wrote that in 1996, I think many scholars have said, well, that was fundamentally wrong, that really we do have national governments asserting their power on the internet, and this is something that's been solved. Virtual worlds, I think, question that in the sense that the platform owners in virtual worlds have such power through copyright, through property law, through anti-hacking laws, through contract. They have such ability to shape these communities and to set rules and to enforce the rules on the communities that their private law powers amount to something that looks a lot like a new legal jurisdiction. And, you know, and that points back, I think, to the idea of the castle, that this is a new technology that enables communities to create separate, you know, rules that are important to them. And we can recognize that as the emergence of law, I think, even if it is not recognized as a kind of new formal legal jurisdiction.
Just to probe a little bit deeper, if this vision is true, it just seems so different from what we have now. It's just such a mind game to try to figure out how these virtual spaces could set themselves up as completely separate legal entities. It seems like there always will need to be a separate overarching kind of governance in the real world.
I think, you know, there is a precedent for this insofar as you look at something like the emergence of increasing, you know, gated communities that set up their own kind of separate roles for how you're supposed to behave, you know, within this community and what your obligations are to other community members. You have the kind of privatization of the town square turning into a shopping mall, you know, that's governed by a kind of, you know, private commercial rulership that's separate from, you know, the past legal precedent. And, you know, if you look at something like Facebook, right? Facebook is governed by its online contract. It has control over its platform. But when it makes a change in, you know, its interface or in its privacy policy, people get outraged and they think that something should be done about this. But they're essentially appealing to Facebook as a company to recognize, you know, their interests. So
it's a fiefdom.
It's a fiefdom, right? And I think, you know, it's not just virtual worlds. They're kind of the canary in the coal mine in this, you know, whole constellation of internet-based, you know, businesses, in the sense that, you know, these are really heavily immersive communities with a great deal of technological sophistication, and they are social software platforms that encourage, you know, kind of substantial community investments in this kind of virtual space. But I think we're seeing things trend this way with other, you know, web-based, internet-based platforms. So I think what we're seeing in terms of the emergence of a kind of private jurisdiction with separate rules in virtual worlds is something we're going to see across different platforms. We're going to see it in a lot of more conventional and probably more popular spaces as well. The book, I think, sounds like an argument for a more kind of activist approach towards the state with regard to the regulation of these online communities. And I'm not sure I'm completely committed to that. I think part of what makes these places so fascinating is the uncertainty about, you know, well, should I really do this? You know, what are the, you know, is this a place where I can actually sort of escape into a alternative legal regime that has some kind of, you know, real purchase, but at the same time is not clearly defined in terms of the law. So there's a certain kind of pleasure, I think, in, you know, being on the boundaries of legal rules. And the early internet, you know, was often called a kind of lawless, you know, frontier. And I think I'm making the same characterization of virtual worlds today as being sort of, you know, anarchic frontiers. And I think we lose something when we actually the state steps in and sets down the rules. We lose a lot of the creativity and a lot of the entrepreneurial, you know, spirit of these places.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. This is a really interesting book, and I've really enjoyed talking to you about it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Greg Listoka is a professor of law at Rutgers University and the author of the book Virtual Justice. You can find out more about him and links to his work on our blog, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Theme music today comes from DJ Drinks and TJ Morgan. All of our episodes are Creative Commons licensed, so feel free to reuse, remix, or play it in the background during an all-night World of Warcraft session. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.